This is the EMDocs.net podcast with Britt Long and Manny Singh. We bring you high-yield content about what you're seeing every day in the ED.
Today, I'm back with Jess Pelletier, EM Education Fellow at Washington University in St. Louis. Jess, great to have you here.
Thanks, Britt. I've brought another guest with me today, Davis Sugar. Davis is a senior neurology resident at Virginia Tech Carilion, my alma mater, and he's here to talk with us about multiple sclerosis management in the emergency department. Thanks for joining us on the show, Davis.
Thanks, Jess and Britt. Excited to be here.
The MS patient with those strange neurologic symptoms always makes me feel a bit anxious in the ED. And I think there are many emergency clinicians who feel this way. These patients, they can have vague symptoms, and it's not always super clear that they're having an MS flare. That new diagnosis of MS, also challenging. So that makes this a perfect topic to talk about on the podcast. Let's start with some background. Jess, fill me in on what MS is and what the major risk factors are.
MS is an autoimmune disease affecting oligodendrocytes, which is a mouthful. They're the nerve cells responsible for myelinating the axons of neurons, resulting in demyelination and axonal loss within the central nervous system. MS is a disease with high morbidity, particularly in patients with delayed diagnosis. This illness typically affects women and presents in patients ages 20 to 40. Risk factors include northern latitudes, vitamin D deficiency, EBV infection, smoking, genetics, and other autoimmune diseases, since those tend to cluster together. Most patients with MS will initially present with long-tracked signs or symptoms, which happen in almost half, and less frequently with optic neuritis, seen in 21% of patients, or brainstem syndromes, which are more rare in about 10% of patients. 23% will present with multifocal symptoms, and unfortunately, those individuals have a worse prognosis.
What do you mean by long-tracked signs?
Some of these are obvious, but others can be misinterpreted as psychiatric symptoms, so we definitely need to keep them on our radar. Long-tracked signs can include upper motor myelopathy, asymmetric spastic paraplegia, and even urinary or erectile dysfunction. The weirder ones are Lhermitte sign, which is an electric shock sensation when the neck is flexed, or Brown-Séquard syndrome, which we more typically associate with trauma, as well as something called the MS hug, which was new to me when I was looking this stuff up. The MS hug refers to a sensation of having a band wrapped around the torso, and this occurs secondary to thoracic demyelination. Altered fine sensation, vibration sensation, or proprioception can also be seen, and patients with MS may have a sensory level.
Definitely a lot of variety there. The optic neuritis and brainstem syndromes are probably more familiar to us. Optic neuritis usually presents with painful visual loss. There's often changes in color vision. Bilateral intranuclear ophthalmoplegia is that discoordination of lateral eye movements when the patient looks to either side. That's the classic brainstem finding. But we can also find abducens nerve palsy, dysarthria, dysphagia, facial numbness, even direction changing nystagmus. Davis, you're our neurology expert. Tell me, how do we actually make a diagnosis of MS?
So MS is diagnosed based on the McDonald criteria. It changes every couple of years, but the last revision one was in 2017. Patients can partially meet these criteria, and we refer to these patients as having possible MS. We can't make this diagnosis until other differentials are excluded, however. There is a table associated with this, but you can just listen along. You don't need to follow with the table. How I want you to look at it is MS can be diagnosed radiographically or clinically. If it's radiographically, it can be isolated, known as radiographically isolated syndrome, or it can be clinically isolated, known as clinically isolated syndrome. Each of these have their respective clinical features, for the radiographic just on the MRI, and for the clinical just on the clinical signs and symptoms. Either of these can progress to MS and have different rates of progression. Once they are at MS, MS can be divided into three categories.
One.
First is called relapse-remitting MS, and it's characterized by intermittent relapses with partial or full recovery in between. The other one are primary and secondary MS, where
two.
Primary MS, you have a steady neurological decline. You know, the initial symptoms present and you don't have any relapses. It just continues on forward.
Three.
The other one is a secondary progressive MS, where you have an initial clinical attack. It regresses for a little while and then come back, and then it proceeds and it deteriorates. Syndromes are all treated the same. In an acute situation, it's with corticosteroids. And then disease-modified therapy can be started afterwards or modified accordingly. To call a presentation clinically isolated syndrome, the patient must have symptoms for 24 hours in the absence of any infection. So I know that was a lot of information, but you can refer to the table if you need to see more.
Yeah, Davis and I will include a table in the show notes that people can take a look at.
All right, bunch of different criteria there, different phenotypes, but it sounds like radiologically isolated syndrome and clinically isolated syndrome may or may not progress to primary progressive MS or PPMS, relapsing remitting MS or RRMS, or secondary progressive MS, which is SPMS. Do I have that right?
Yes, definitely.
Perfect. Are there any risk factors that potentially put patients at a higher risk for progressing to one of those severe phenotypes like RRMS or the PPMS?
Yes, Britt. Risk factors for MS development in RIS patients include spinal cord involvement, male sex, and age less than 37 years at diagnosis. In terms of risk factors for progressing from CIS to RRMS, PPMS, or SPMS, these include age less than 30, so younger patients, non-Caucasian race, motor symptoms, multifocal symptoms, increased EBV antigen titer, smoking, as well as an increased number or size of radiographic lesions on MRI.
All right, let's pivot here. And Davis, what do you recommend that we do in the ED for our evaluation? Say the patient comes in with neurologic symptoms that we think could be due to MS.
Well, for the possible CIS patient, we need to exclude alternative causes of their symptoms. So most of these patients will receive extensive laboratory workup and imaging, including an MRI, before receiving the formal CIS diagnosis. For patients with established MS, we do need to differentiate relapse from exacerbation and from pseudo-relapse. True relapse consists of worsening of the baseline neurologic symptoms with a significant change in neurologic examination for at least 24 hours with 30 days of preceding clinical stability. We can think of pseudo-relapse like recrudescence in stroke patients. Symptoms may wax and wane and last less than 24 hours. It's important to know that physical stresses such as infection can trigger a relapse or a pseudo-relapse, so sources of infection, particularly urinary tract infection, should be identified and treated. Also, heat, menstruation, and emotional stressors can bring on pseudo-relapses. In the emergency department, the workup for an established MS patient coming in with neurological symptoms should include many things, including a CBC, CMP, UA, ECG, and a chest x-ray. For the CIS, the clinician should discuss the case with neurology, as there may be a lot of other tests to order. Finally, patients with new focal deficits should undergo a CT head, plus or minus a CTA head and neck, and perfusion scanning to exclude stroke or alternative causes of symptoms.
That differentiation of relapse or exacerbation versus pseudo-relapse, that's definitely a key point here. Think about that 24-hour threshold and whether there are new neurologic deficits or changes. When do we need to pull the trigger on other scans or imaging versus just a head CT or CTA?
MRI with contrast is the ideal strategy for diagnosing suspected CIS or an MS flare. If you can't localize the patient's symptoms to the brain, they definitely need an MRI with contrast of the full spine as well.
That makes perfect sense. It all comes back to localization. Jess, let's say we've made the diagnosis of clinically isolated syndrome or a true MS relapse versus that pseudo-relapse. Should we be treating all these patients with steroids?
Yes, Britt. We shouldn't delay corticosteroid administration if we're highly suspicious for MS flare and if there's going to be a delay to obtaining MRI. Unfortunately, if we give corticosteroids, it can lead to a false negative MRI. So we need to make sure that the MRI gets done within 3 days of steroid administration. The standard corticosteroid therapy recommended for MS flares is high-dose methylprednisolone. So we're talking 1 gram IV for 3 to 5 days, way more than we give for most other conditions. There's some data out there that oral corticosteroids can be prescribed as an alternative, but I wouldn't do that without consulting neurology because this isn't common practice yet. For patients who have symptoms refractory to corticosteroids, plasmapheresis is actually a second-line option. We should also be treating any underlying infection that's triggering a patient's first-time presentation of MS or relapse. Reducing fever is super important in ill patients, since, as Davis mentioned earlier, heat makes MS symptoms worse. Keep in mind that patients who are on disease-modifying therapy, which is immunosuppressive, can be susceptible to infections that we see in other immunocompromised patients, like our HIV population with low CD4 counts or patients on chemotherapy.
You hit on looking for and treating an underlying trigger like infection. Very important here. It sounds like it's better to err on the side of giving steroids if you suspect it's clinically isolated syndrome or an MS flare. But if we can, get the MRI before the steroids because treatment can potentially result in falsely negative imaging. Davis, which of these patients needs to be admitted?
If patients are presenting with new neurological symptoms lasting more than 24 hours and that are disabling, they need to be admitted. If they have non-disabling new neurological symptoms lasting greater than 24 hours, precipitating causes should be identified and need for admission versus the possibility of outpatient management can be considered and discussed with neurology. Pseudo-relapses with worsening of baseline exam should be worked up similarly to truly relapses and admission versus discharge discussed with neurology. For pseudo-relapse with no significant change in baseline exam, or for the MS patients coming in with non-neurological issues, they should be treated similar to other ED patients, but with consideration for those on disease-modifying therapies, as they may be at risk for different types of infections than our immunocompetent patients.
We're going to have an algorithm of what Davis just discussed in the show notes, so you can check that out if you want to review any information here.
Davis, great breakdown on disposition and what we need to be thinking about for these patients. Let's go through some take-home points. MS is an autoimmune disorder that targets the CNS and can cause severe disability. This is a clinical diagnosis based on the McDonald criteria. Radiologically isolated syndrome and clinically isolated syndrome may or may not develop into chronic MS. We break this further down into RRMS, PPMS, or SPMS. We need to make this diagnosis. Early diagnosis and treatment of clinically isolated syndrome or an MS relapse can delay the next relapse. Pseudorelapse is different. This has a short duration of less than 24 hours with a waxing and waning course, and there's no new neurologic deficits. If you're concerned about MS or you have a patient with established MS and you're concerned about a relapse or exacerbation, involve your neurology specialist early. They will help you with the diagnosis and evaluation, treatment, and also disposition. MRI is the imaging modality of choice for these patients, but not all these patients necessarily need one. If they have new neurologic symptoms that are not disabling, they have a clear pseudorelapse, or if they have non-neurologic medical complaints, they probably don't need the MRI, but just speak with your neurologist. You also don't need an MRI of the spinal cord if these symptoms don't localize there. When it comes to therapy for clinically isolated syndrome or an MS relapse or exacerbation, the first-line treatment is steroids. Find and treat any trigger as well. Justin Davis, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks, Britt.
Thanks so much for having us, Britt, and super excited to have Davis on the podcast. I hope we'll be able to collaborate on future projects.
It was a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Stay safe and healthy, everyone.